Namaste and welcome to the Healing Mirror Podcast. My name is Saraya Saraswati, and here I'm offering discussions, global satsangs, and interviews with spiritual teachers, philanthropists, and awakened and inspirational humans. Namaste, everyone. And namaste, Gangaji. This is the Healing Mirror podcast here. And I'd like to introduce a very special guest today. Gangaji is someone I've been aware of for a very, very long time. And I read a couple of your books during the 90s, but I was busy raising children then, so I never got to see you when you were in Australia. Gangaji's earlier life was rich in spiritual practice, such as Zen, Tibetan Buddhist meditation, as well as the Vipassana line. Prior to meeting her master, she had a full life as a mother, a wife, a meditation teacher, and a therapist. Still, she felt a deep longing that was largely unrealized until she met a man who changed her life. And it was her husband, I believe, Eli Jackson Baer, who called her to India to meet a man who he shared with her was the real deal. And there on the banks of the Ganga, Gangaji met Sri Punja, who was known affectionately as Papaji. And it was in Papaji's presence and through his grace that Gangaji came to full self-realization or self-recognition. Her personal journey of suffering, searching, and seeking ended, and her true life's journey began to flower, free of any resistance. Gangaji's dedicated her life since then to sharing Papaji's message, to sharing that far and wide, and she's come here to Australia and to many parts of the world to offer satsang. She's authored and co-authored over 10 books. And something I'm looking forward to hearing about is her work in the prison system in the US as well. So Gangaji's coming to us here. We're meeting in cyberspace. Gangaji's in the US and I'm here in Australia. So welcome, Gangaji.
Thank you. Really happy to be here with you.
So I'll swap my glasses now. I would love to hear more about your meeting with Papaji. I have watched some of the old videos from India of Papaji, and when I first saw him, he's just so full of heart and so affectionate and so lovable that I was really, really touched. As I'm sure you were to meet him at that time. So many people who may be listening to this podcast may never have heard of your wonderful work or Papaji's. So perhaps you can share some of that story with our listeners.
Happy to. Always happy to. It's such a mystery to me that I would have ended up in India meeting this incredibly loving and lovable and playful and deep person that I called Papaji. I had gotten to a place in my life where I had a good life and I was relatively happy, but I was aware of this kernel of suffering that was within me, it seemed, all the time, and would surface if there was anything that would go off in my body or my circumstances or my mind. And so I knew I needed something more than I knew about. I knew about meditation. I knew about Buddhist practice. I knew about New Age spirituality. I never did psychotherapy, but I was aware of it and I knew the value of it. And I needed help. So I prayed for help. I just prayed to the universe for help for a teacher. But I really didn't expect it to be an Indian guru in India. I had never wanted to go to India. And I had actually seen the abuse in the guru student, guru devotee roles. And so I wasn't interested in that. But by a series of miraculous events, I ended up at Papaji's front door, knocking on the door. And he opened the door, and he was this huge presence. He was a tall man, especially for an Indian. He was a Punjabi, so he was like 6 feet tall and big. And he said, "Welcome." He just threw out his arms and he said, "Welcome." And I was, oh, I felt the force of that and the grace of that. And I fell in love. I had heard something about him from Eli, my husband, and from another American student that he had affected greatly. And so I knew I was meeting someone worth meeting, but still the impact was really surprising. And he right away asked me, "What do you want? Why are you here?" And I said, "I want freedom." I couldn't even say I knew exactly what that meant. I could have said, "I want love or peace or enlightenment." And he said, "You're in the right place." And I knew that. I knew that he was my teacher. So I really, and I knew he was an answer to that prayer. So I really paid very close attention to what he said. And I said, "Tell me what to do." Really expecting to get a new practice or a new mantra or a new direction of what I needed to learn or study or practice. And he said, "Don't do anything. Just stop doing anything." And that jolted me for a moment, but then I thought I knew what he meant. So I got into my meditative pose and I stopped paying attention to what was going on around me. And he said, no, stop that too. And it's began to sink in what he meant when he said, "Stop doing anything." It was, I had never heard it. If it had been said to me before, I had never heard it. And it was terrifying because I could see how deeply I was actively avoiding stopping, that stopping meant death to me, or it meant at the very least regression back to a certain state that I had somehow made it out of through practices, through meditation, through right livelihood. And so I was afraid, but I also trusted that I could, out of my own curiosity, inquire into this and stop. And if it was the wrong thing, then I trusted myself to recognize that. So that was the moment really where I was willing to stop, to be unprotected. And he said, "Now what is here?" And I was struck by the space, by the peace, by the love. And he said, "That's your own self. How far do you have to go to get there?" So this was my meeting with him. And at that time I was with him just 6 weeks, but so rich and deep and filled with his grace. And he said one morning, "I had a dream about you, and I dreamed that your name is the Ganga." We were meeting by the Ganga. He had a little cottage by the Ganga. And so he gave me the name Ganga. He said, "Now when you go back, tell people to call you Gangaji." And at first I thought, I'll never do that. That's not my style. I mean, I'm not going to do that. I've made fun of people coming back from India with Indian names. But he then followed that up with saying, "You make yourself available. And if people have questions for you, they'll come to you. And you tell them your name is Gangaji." The G part is a respectful addition to Ganga. And just speak from your own experience. And I was really startled at that, because I was very much a student. I'm still a student. And he said, good, that's right. And he sent me out to meet people. And that's what I've been doing since then. That was 30 years ago. And blissfully, and that's what brings me here to you and to everyone listening and viewing you. And really, I'm here not to give a teaching. As he said, it was no teaching. It was really an invitation to for this moment, to take this time to stop and see what is always here.
It's almost an undoing, isn't it? It's almost unseeing, because I actually spent the 80s in an ashram, and having left that system, also see many, many flaws, although it was all started with great heart and with great enthusiasm and from the right place. And I gained many deep learnings and understandings from my time there. I also saw the flaws in that system as well, because we're all human. And, unless we actually have experienced the true knowing, know thyself, then we're still acting from all the patterns and the history that we've taken on. And I love the way you express, because it was my experience too, that it's actually so simple. Mm-hmm. So simple, coming back or dropping in to presence of who we are, yet we make it so complicated.
Well, it is absolutely simple, but it is also the challenge of a lifetime.
Indeed.
Because we are attuned to complications. That's part of our survival mechanism. And we're habituated to complications because that's the drama and the entertainment of life. And for me, in that moment of being challenged to really stop and to have no ledge to stand on and to have no teaching to remember, but to stop in this deep place was terrifying. Because I was afraid of my own self. I don't know what I imagined, just something, I think, wild and untamed and atavistic maybe. And then to discover the simplicity and the spaciousness and the beauty and that it was always here, because that's a major part of the discovery. It's not something new. It's just what was in the background is all of a sudden the totality.
It's the great cosmic joke, really, isn't it? We run around the world searching and looking for something that's right here, right now, and ever available.
Yes.
I love that quote by Gandhi, the divine radio is always playing. We just need to tune in.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of laughter in awakening, and there was a lot of laughter with Bapaji, and he said, when you're laughing, you can't think.
So I totally agree with that. And so also, something I've experienced is when you're singing, you can't think, because I
that's
sing
right.
as well. And when I'm singing, I think that's one of the reasons I love it so much. Thinking is just not there.
Yeah. That's right.
Gone.
Yes. But you are there. And so you don't need to be thought to be. And that's what we are conditioned, that we somehow have to imagine ourselves or think ourselves or remember ourselves in the past and project ourselves in the future. It's here. You are here. It is here.
Right now. So when you came back to the US, how long did you actually spend there with Papaji?
That first visit was just 6 weeks, and I came back and somebody did come up to me and asked me, what have you realized? You seem really different, because they had known me before. So I just started speaking to people, 2, 3, 5 people. And I went back again. That was in April. I went back to India in September and was with him again for a little period of time. And so I would then make visits, and we corresponded. He was a beautiful letter writer. So I have lots of letters that I saved, of course. And he just was encouraging me to share my experience if it was wanted, if someone came up or if a group of people said, what if you realized? And at that time, Osho died. And as you know, Osho had a huge following.
Yeah.
And they were looking for a new guru. I think Osho maybe said to them, when I die, find a new teacher. And they found Papaji. And so all of a sudden, it was an explosion there. From when I was with Papaji, maybe 5 other people, sometimes as many as 15. But once the Osho people found Papaji, it was hundreds of people came in. So he was just rolling with it. It was his same teaching. And a lot of the videos that are out were actually made from the Osho people. They had the
There's quite a few on YouTube, isn't there? And some of them are just, they're so beautiful. He really did emanate sweetness.
Sweetness, and he could be, quite strong too. I mean, he was very playful, and he was in his 80s by the time those videos are made. And so, and he was seeing the fruits of his time with Ramana Maharshi and his long times alone, and his students were waking up. But he was a lion too. He really, if you came to him and said, oh, Papaji, I had it and now I lost it. He wasn't willing to process you or to, let's see, what did you do? He would say, if you lost it, you didn't value it, get out of the room. So you knew that you couldn't use him to be your foil to work with you, that it was, this is a moment with him where you had to take full responsibility.
And that's the work, isn't it, really? It does require effort of seeing through those mental patterns when they come up to sort of pull us in time and time again.
Absolutely. That's the vigilance is the word I use for that. And yes, and he said to me, because I don't know how the question arose, maybe I asked him, do I always have to be vigilant? And he said, until your last breath. And I realized later, it's because that's the way our minds are made. They are objectifying experience. And
absolutely.
And this can't be objectified. So you have to be willing to be humbled and to be a student and to see freshly.
Yeah. I often, I run a little global satsang myself, and that often comes up. It's like, when won't I fall in the doo-doo? We have a little joke, we keep falling in the doo-doo, but it's that recognition and seeing that we've fallen for the mind stuff again and coming back constantly. And when doesn't that happen? With a human body and a human mind, that can happen, as you say, as Papaji says, till our last breath. I love that.
Yeah. Well, doo-doo is natural, isn't it? I mean, it's part of the process. I remember telling someone what happens is that you learn to change your own diapers. You don't go to somebody else to change your diapers for you. It's like, whoops.
That's great. I love that. We take responsibility for our own.
Yeah. And people have heard responsibility when I've said that, because I think surrender and responsibility of two are the most beautiful words in the English language. But people hear responsibility and they often hear or think of something as a burden, like the question, when will this end? But it's really this capacity to respond, the listening, the capacity to overhear your own thoughts your own narrative, your own unnecessary suffering. That's the doo-doo, you know? And so then, yeah, so I see that. It's not that it's wrong that it appears, but I don't have to follow it into suffering. I can actually be still.
And that's where the choice comes in, you know, when we can make that shift from choosing to follow something that's untrue and will only lead to suffering, or to just sit in presence and watch the clouds go by. It's a wonderful
thing. That's it, isn't it?
Beautiful. And some of the work, because there is a Gangaji foundation now, can you share a little bit about the foundation? And something I'm particularly interested in is the work you do in prisons, because I feel that could be so valuable. Many years ago, I taught yoga in a prison and meditation. And I was quite young then. And talking to these male prisoners, they said, teach us a way that we can get out of here. They wanted to learn astral travel. And I said, well, you know, you don't really need to learn astral travel. You just need to drop, you know, drop in rather than drop out. And so I'm really interested in your program, how that works, and where you're focusing with that.
Yes, I was, I met Papaji in 1990, and by 1992, I was in Boulder, Colorado. And there was a group, because those were some of the first big meetings, and there was a group that had formed around me who suggested that we form a nonprofit foundation. It sounded like a good thing. And at the very same time, there was an invitation to come into a Colorado prison. And I hadn't thought of that or imagined a meeting with prisoners, but it just felt right. It seemed right. And those were really extraordinary meetings for me and for some of the prisoners too. A couple of them ended up, after they got out of prison, of becoming teachers themselves. It was just extraordinary because, well, first of all, the process of going into prison, as you must remember, is complicated and maybe terrifying in a certain way. The searches and the different doors and the layers that close behind you, and then to meet with these men. This was an all-male prison, and of course, there were a small percentage of the prison population. I think there were probably 30 men, and the population was probably 3,000. But of those 3,000 people incarcerated, these 30 had some spark and had real questions. And we met in a beautiful, true human to human way. And that continued. But what really startled me about it was when I came back into Boulder and was continuing my meetings there, which were getting quite large, I was able to share with those people the experience I had in prison and how there was no difference. And I found that the prisoners' realizations really lit up the non-prisoners' inquiries. First of all, the situations, when you realize what freedom we have relatively compared to our prisoners, you stop complaining about a lot of things. And then just to realize that these guys could wake up in prison in the worst of circumstances, that was somehow catching, contagious to the people outside of prison. They didn't have as many excuses of why not me, but still I have to do this, and I haven't finished this, or I still get angry. It's just, it cleared the slate. So I realized this relationship with inside, outside is really the crux of the teaching, because we think there is some barrier inside and outside. And when that's examined and inquired into, it's the same self waking up to itself in the worst of circumstances or in circumstances that are relatively quite nice. So that has continued over the years. We have a correspondence program where people on the outside, volunteer to correspond with people on the inside. And that's been quite beautiful. And it's monitored so that the correspondence really just stays about satsang, that it's not about personal issues.
So it's more of a dialogue, a spiritual dialogue, and stays on that level rather than getting into the nitty-gritty of personal history.
Yes, absolutely.
And so do you have teachers that are actually going in to the prison and offering teaching there, or is it done by correspondence? I wasn't quite clear about that.
Yeah, we had quite a few people going in, but the prison system about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, went through some kind of a negative change, and they threw out a lot of the spiritual teachers. They did major lockdowns. I don't know what was happening, but we got kicked out, and we still petitioned to get back in. You need a particular relationship with the chaplain. So at this point, we have correspondence, and then we have a monthly newsletter that goes out to prisoners and connects with them. And they're usually new prisoners that's going out to, as well as the ones who've been receiving it for the last year or so. So, yeah, it was quite a jolt, you know, because we had volunteers in several states going in, and they loved it. And so they were heartbroken to have that severed. But that's the nature of the system.
It's a privilege. I found it personally a privilege to go in there and to teach. It was humbling, and like you, the few people that came to the class were really sincere and wonderful people who had found themselves in extraordinary circumstances, you know, due to their history or patterns or whatever. But they were amazing people.
It's enlightening, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I'm very privileged to live in the forest here in Australia on the Sunshine Coast, which is the east coast of Australia.
Yes, I've traveled to Byron a lot. I had a lot of retreats in Byron.
Oh, Byron. Well, okay, so we're 4 hours north of Byron. Byron's lovely.
Oh, beautiful, and the hinterland out from Byron is just some of the most beautiful country.
Well, I live in the hinterland, which is quite similar to that, but 4 hours north.
Ah, must be beautiful.
Yes, yeah, it is. It's a privilege, and I feel very blessed to live here, particularly at this time. I mean, we're living in unprecedented times, and another tumultuous time perhaps in human history at the moment, and with so much seeming chaos and change going on, I always look to that as, you know, the stirring of the pot can sometimes be a clearing as well. How are you feeling about what's going on in the human dilemma?
It's quite intense, you know.
It's quite intense here.
I mean, the virus definitely has had a huge effect, and it's a serious thing. But then the Black Lives Matter and recognizing the brutality that most Black people have had to be aware of, and many, too many, have had to experience, has been really a waking up and a sobering for our nation, because this has been going on since slavery, and the Civil War didn't fix it. And so I grew up in the south of our country in Mississippi, and was very much conditioned to see Black people as inferior somehow, not with hatred, but just with a superior attitude. And so some time ago in the 60s, I really was able to see that and reverse that. But I see that the whole nation has to, and unfortunately we have terrible leadership right now in terms of political leadership. But there is the good side of it, and I wept with joy the other day, a couple of weeks ago when the marches were happening, to see so many young people just appalled at the horror and saying, no more, this cannot exist.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening in Australia with the Aboriginal population, but they're certainly included in Black Lives Matter.
I have three sons who are, you know, half Indian, but they look quite Aboriginal. So that really made me very, very conscious as a white mother. My husband died, so I was a white mother with dark children. And they were beautiful, you know, just very handsome boys. And however, you know, the prejudice that they experienced and that I was helpless as a mother to change made me very, very, very conscious of this split, you know. And I grew up in out west, like in rural, very rural Australia when I was young, and there's quite a large Aboriginal population there. And again, that prejudice. I mean, in Australia, Aboriginal people weren't recognised as human till 1960. And then they didn't get the vote till after that. You know, they weren't even recognised as human citizens. And that's inconceivable, isn't it?
It's so horrendous.
And things are slow to change. I'm sure it's the same in the US, in particularly out west, in areas where they're sort of cut off from what's happening more in the modern world, and that they're stuck in their ways. So I remember actually Prince, I'm not sure what he calls himself now, but did some amazing music with this heart in it for the black population and their call for equality. And then when I listened to the audio book with him and you and Eli sharing Papaji's work, that really touched me very, very deeply, actually. So, yeah, of course, the government didn't want those to go ahead because of the COVID, but at the last minute they got it through the courts that they could go ahead. So we've had big marches here for with the Aboriginal and many other races as well here.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Because my heart is really in Australia, and I have recognized that issue. I mean, I grew up with it, so I recognized it in the culture there. It's Prince Ea. It's E-A. I think he calls it Ea.
Prince Ea. I think he says Ea, actually. Yeah, he's wonderful. Yeah.
He is.
Yeah, he is a really... I would love to interview him one day too.
Oh, he'd totally be open to it. Yes,
okay.
Just connect with him. He
I
put
really
out an
expect.
Did you see his last video? The one he put out where he was enacting the experience of a policeman with a knee on the neck choking, and it's incredible. If you go to his YouTube and do Prince Ea, it'll show you.
Okay, I'll share that on as well.
Yes, and please, yes, interview him. He would have a lot of fun with you, and he's a very serious, very intelligent young man. And
yeah, well, I picked that up just from the lyric, and my boys all love hip hop, you see. So
there you go.
So when they were playing it, I listened to his lyrics and I went, I like that one. And then I looked a little bit more, you know, a few years ago now. And then, of course, I came across the book. What is it? Roar.
Mm-hmm. Wake Up and Roar.
Wake Up and Roar. Brilliant. I just loved I particularly like the audio or the audible, because you can actually listen. And I love that. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Good.
You know, on all sorts of levels, things are, the pot is being stirred, and it's time. It's time to come out of the dark ages and to have equality.
Yes, may it be so. May the clarity come forth.
You know, if more people see the truth, and then And then once we've done that, we can do no harm. We just couldn't possibly do harm then.
Or if we do, we take responsibility for it. You know, that's
an immediate responsibility.
Yes, because you are harming your own self. So it's not a separate pain or a separate suffering.
No. Yeah. No, you're very, very right. When we fall in the doo-doo, we feel it immediately.
Yes. Yes. You feel it. You smell it. You sense it. Time to get rid of it. Put it back into the earth.
Yeah. It's so refreshing to speak to someone else who gets it. And sometimes this body can feel like a little bit of an island, but the internet is such a wonderful thing. Now there's so much sharing, like your wonderful videos, and I hope everyone listening is going to look up Gangaji on YouTube, because there's some amazing videos. And also you can donate toward the prison program. I think you have a donations area there as well. So this is the sort of work that we can support and know that, you know, goodness is being done here with no ego involved. And you know, ego is a strange word, because we all need that to experience life. So it's not such a dirty word, but with no selfishness or unkindness.
Yeah. Yes, cleanly. With the COVID shutdown, we are discovering how to connect with people. And this is certainly one way, and a beautiful way, to just that Zoom is available, and that we can actually be in each other's living rooms across the world from each other. It's that connection you're speaking of, that's really the essence that really supports individually awakening and collectively awakening. And so we're always just waiting to hear, you know, what is the question? Where's the draw? I mean, it was beautiful to get your invitation. It was like Barbara Denenpont runs the organization, and she said, oh yes, this is good. This is a connection. So it's like that. It's reaching out to one another and encouraging each other. And we are alone, but we are all together alone. And I think that this is the time to make that just more and more certain.
It's interesting, isn't it? We're alone, but we're not. We're one. And as you were speaking then, Gangaji, I had this beautiful image of the planet with a web of little beautiful, like a spider's web of light connecting us all, these little dots through Zoom. and like a beautiful hug around the earth, you know. And yeah, coming beautiful. Together like this is so nourishing. It's and reaffirming as well that the simplicity and the beauty that is here and is available really doesn't need to be complicated.
Beautiful.
Yeah. It's such a blessing, blessing. And I think, and I just know, I feel from you that, you know, when we drop into our heart and we let go of our history, and, you know, we've all had challenging times, we've all, you know, had pain. And one of the sons I told you about died by suicide in a hospital where he was treated and not cared for when he was 17. So, you know, we've all been there, we've all had difficult times, but yet that love and that joy and that presence is always and ever available, and it's always right here.
It brings so much to it. It's not trivial. It's deep, and it's present in all of us.
Yes. Yeah. So I love your message. I love the beautiful, graceful, intelligent way that you share your message. which is the one message we really all need to.
I'm so happy to meet you like this. It's wonderful. It's this, as you, the beautiful image you gave of this, the lighting up to know you're in northeastern Australia, lighting up this, and we're in Oregon in the US, and these lights are connecting.
Absolutely. And, yeah. And through these beautiful connections and all those that'll be tuning in and listening and being with us in this as well, we're creating all these points of light around this beautiful Mother Earth. So
we're so lucky then.
Oh, blessed. So have you anything else you would love to share with all those that are listening and all those that I know will just gain so much from your eloquent wisdom?
Well, I really usually end interviews and moments with people in inviting everyone to actually trust themselves. And I have to qualify that. I don't mean trust your thoughts. I don't mean trust your emotions or even your intuition. It's deeper than that. To trust this within you that is yearning for home, for truth, for peace. And it is quite able to direct you to exactly where you need to be, which is where you are. And that's where we meet, finally, all of us.
That's a beautiful invitation. And it's a powerful one. I remember when that woke up in me when I was quite young, that it was actually a pain in my heart. That yearning was so painful that I couldn't ignore that call. And I'm sure you can relate to that perfectly. And so many of us feel that and mistake that perhaps for human love, or you know, we've added so much to love, haven't we, that there's so many extras put there when it's just this.
Yes, homesickness.
That's really beautiful. I thank you so much, and I invite everybody to please have a look at Gungaji's website. I'll put that link down the bottom of this video and add it into the podcast. And there's some wonderful YouTube videos of Gungaji speaking. Have a look at the prison program. It's actually something I thought would be wonderful to have here in Australia. Have you done any work in Australia, or have any of your members that are here in Australia, have they approached the prison programs here?
There's definitely an interest in Australia, and I don't actually know how much it's been developed. I know around Byron there were a couple of people who were already going into the prisons, and so they just brought some of this information or invitation with them. Because yes, it's a, you know, it's a universal issue, this prison population. It's really a big issue in the States. We have a huge rate of incarceration, and I don't know what the situation is in Australia. I know also in Canada we have people going in, but it's not as big of an issue. There's not as much imprisonment as there is in the United States. It's really horrific here, how many people are imprisoned for nonviolent crimes, and how bad the prisons are, overcrowded, and how little rehabilitation they really offer. And so that's been the focus, has been in the US, but definitely we always support everyone wherever they are. If they feel inclined to reach out to that prison population, we are here to support you.
Yeah, when I first went to the US, I think we're a little bit extra blessed here in Australia down under, because we're protected. We have a smaller population. We're so far away from the rest of the world. And we don't have that extreme poverty and the homelessness. When I first flew into LA and visited some different US cities, I was shocked with that homelessness. I was shocked with the level of mental illness that was out there on the streets to see. And the fact that there's no care, free hospital care for people or free mental health cover for people. And when, you know, the Obama care came in, I thought, oh, thank goodness. You know, that's long overdue. But of course, unfortunately, I think that's been stopped now by a less enlightened decision. But
well, it's being stopped. It's being dismantled. It's still there somewhat, but we have a huge problem, and it's a shocking problem, and we need to be shocked by it to recognize the scope of it.
It's more in Australia here. We still, I mean, we have such a much smaller population, particularly when you look at the area we've gotten. You know, it's a big island, Australia, and we've got a small population, which is mainly around the coastal areas. But what we do have here is too much incarceration of our Indigenous people. Yes. And too many deaths in custody, because our Indigenous people here, the Aboriginal people are used to being nomadic. You know, their land is their life, their connection with earth. So to be locked away in a room is like death for them. Mm. And there's a huge problem there with deaths, Aboriginal deaths in custody. So yes, we do have our own issues, but when I look at the US and the population and the number of unsupported people with mental health issues or who have been incarcerated and the poverty there, it's so sad. Wow. So sad. And of course, we don't have, people can't walk around with guns here. That makes a big difference.
Yes. That makes a huge difference. Australia is really the beacon for people, because you did have that and you stopped it. And then violent gun deaths stopped. And so we do speak of Australia and how they were, how you were able to abolish carrying guns around. So may the clarity of true vision and open heart be revealed in all hearts, in all places.
And that's why this work and your words are so important. You know, if there's anything we can do, if rather than, you know, criticizing the system or calling it wrong, let's wake up, you know, let's open our hearts, let's do something, whatever we are called to do. And we're all called to do different things, but whatever that calling is, you know, to follow that, if that's going to uplift even one other person's life. The thought that someone will, you know, face the dark night of their soul without realizing the light that is here is heartbreaking.
Well, I'm glad you're being used so beautifully, and all of your listeners and the people who follow you, and I'm happy we got to meet.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Gangaji. It's just been an absolute pleasure to have you here. So,
yes,
I'm sure all the listeners will appreciate everything.
Thank you. Truly. Namaste. As we begin.
Join me for upcoming podcasts. And please, if you found this helpful, or you'd like to share a comment, or perhaps your own experience, I'd love for you to leave that message down below this podcast. I enjoy reading your feedback, and I'm sure we can all help each other to hold hands, to remain awake, present, clear, and loving. Namaste.